This is Audible.
Audible Originals presents The Room Next Door, written by Wendy Walker, read by Julia Whalen, Elizabeth Evans, B.B. Wood, and a full cast. Part 1. Chapter 1. Brooke. July 1st, 2025. I don't know where to begin. Maybe with the truth, which is that I love my husband. Nothing about the story I'm about to tell you changes that. This night was going to be the last. That's what I told myself. I suppose I've told myself that before, so I won't pretend to know what I might have done or not done if we hadn't been interrupted by those sounds. The sounds coming from the room next door.
What was that?
Shh. I don't know.
We both froze, staring at the wall. We were in the third cottage at the hotel. It has two rooms, but you'd never know it. It had been going on for a while, about 3 months. And in all that time, we never heard a sound, not even a door closing or the pop of champagne. That place, the Four Points Hotel, it was built for privacy. It's miles up the river, away from the ocean, where the woods are deep. We'd chosen it carefully when all of this began. We decided it was best to find one safe haven and then leave nothing to chance. It was also a way, I think, of easing our minds about the people we'd lied to. I told Aiden I had meetings with my writer's group. He told his wife he had client dinners. It's not like the hotels along the ocean that attract the tourists. I should know, with my family owning the East Bay Inn, arguably the most iconic among them, right? Every room at the inn is rented, and the entire population of East Bay triples for 3 months of the year. You can't find a spot on the beach or a table at a restaurant. I think it's even worse now. But oh, how we loved it when we were teenagers, didn't we? The summer people and the energy they brought, the possibilities. At least, until the summer that Eve disappeared. It's not anything like that at the Four Points. There's no lobby, no front desk, just the four cottages with two rooms each back to back. One facing the water with a balcony that hangs right over it. The other looking out on a small private courtyard with wrought iron benches and water fountains, meticulous landscaping. The hydrangeas are like beds of colorful cotton balls. Ours were violet and white. More important to us was that each room has private access, with paths that weave in from different directions. It's meant to feel like you've escaped to a secret house that no one knows about, a hideaway managed solely through an app. We never stayed overnight, or even ordered room service, but you can get anything you want, as if by magic. The staff is invisible. But if a guest has a need, it's communicated through the app and taken care of immediately. That's what made it so shocking, hearing those sounds. That night, I got there before he did. I parked in the gravel lot and followed the sign that led to our room, Garden 3, though I knew the way by then. There were other cars there, but not his. I can't remember any of them except nothing unusual, you know, like a Cybertruck or a Lamborghini. I would have remembered those. I got to the room, and it was exactly as I'd requested. Candles smelling of sandalwood and musk, soft linens on the bed turned down, the pillows sprawled across the top of the mattress, and a bottle of Macallan 25 on the bar beside a bucket of ice. I placed my bag down on the small table by the window and pulled the draperies shut. I need to tell you this part, as unimportant as it may seem at first. It matters. My state of mind when this all happened. I took off every piece of my clothing and laid it on the valet stand. I poured a glass of scotch and took a long, slow sip, then another, until I could feel the burn run all the way through my body, chasing away the guilt. I didn't turn when I heard the lock release, and then felt the gust of night air sweep through the open door and climb up my back. I heard him sigh, and then the sound of his shirt sweep across his bare skin and fall to the floor. The click of a buckle, the swish as he pulled it from the loops of his jeans. Always the jeans. They drove me mad. I didn't move a single muscle except to draw a breath, and before I could release it, he was behind me, pressing his body to mine, his rough beard running up my shoulder until I felt his lips brush my ear, his tongue sweeping inside as one hand reached around me, taking both of my wrists. The other hand held the belt, which he wrapped around them. Then he whispered,
"Do you want to play?"
God help me. Yes. Yes.
Babe, you're killing me.
I don't know how long it all lasted after we made it to the bed. When it was over, I pulled him into a long kiss before I let him slip away to get a drink from the bar. I was watching him walk away in the dim light of a candle, thinking how much he reminded me of the boys in high school, how strong their bodies were, how perfect they felt when we held them in our arms. He was fit that way, every part of him hard, except the inside of his hands and his mouth. I'm sorry, I need you to understand why I was there. After 3 months of lying and cheating, swearing it would be the last time, knowing I needed to get back to my life with my husband, with Aiden. But God, how I wanted more of him. Even as I said the words in my head, "It's over now. This has to be the end of it." I never understood how this happened to people until it happened to me. I've had these moments since moving back to East Bay when I first wake up in the morning and smell the salt in the air. When I'm back in time to the summer we graduated from high school, we had our whole lives ahead of us. It felt like the world had made us promises. They were all there, weren't they? Like apples hanging from a tree. We just had to choose the right ones to pluck. I tried to do that after I left. After that summer, I went to college and never looked back. It's strange to think about the person I became. I was like a machine, caring only about winning and achieving. I graduated at the top of my class, got hired at Google, and in New York City. My mother used to say that I liked to light fuses, pull the pins from grenades to blow up my life.
"Why can't you just be a good girl, Brooke?"
And my mother said a lot of things. She still does. But she didn't know what to say then. A girl from East Bay could hardly do any better than that. Fucking Google. I arrived in New York without a single friend. And I didn't care. I didn't want anyone to get close to me. I became almost Machiavellian. For 5 years, I slowly moved up in the hiring division, responsible for finding the best of the best to innovate the world. The job came with responsibility and power, and I ran toward it without a shred of fear or remorse for the people I left behind in my wake. It was Aiden who stopped me in my tracks, nearly 6 years ago now. It's not a romantic story. My name popped up on his LinkedIn feed as someone he might know because of our connection to East Bay. He messaged me one afternoon, and I answered. I didn't think anything of it at the time. Aiden Granger, he was a builder from back home. He'd worked on a renovation at the East Bay Inn years ago, after my family first bought it and then when they expanded. I remembered him. He was married at the time, and they had twin sons who used to pester Tyler, following my poor brother to the game room in the basement. Tyler had that command center down there, rows of PCs and high-speed Wi-Fi. What was that game he played? League of Legends? That sounds right. But the Grangers, they had a house on the water, a big one. It was two houses down from the Rosario's place where we spent every weekend when Eve was dating Connor. How strange is it that I can now see their house from my own back porch? When I met Aiden in New York, he'd been divorced for 3 years. I had no idea he wanted anything romantic when he invited me to dinner. I'd never thought of him that way. But I felt it from the first moment I walked into the restaurant, a small bistro in the West Village. The smile on his face, the way he pulled out my chair, placed his elbows on the table, and rested his chin on his folded hands. He smiled as his eyes took me in, no longer a girl, but a grown woman. We all feel it, don't we? When this shift happens. When we become more than a friend's daughter. It's a human instinct, and we are animals, after all. Still, it took me by surprise. I remember feeling my cheeks flush and my eyes search for anything to look at other than his face. I wasn't ready to see the possibility, this choice that was now in front of me. He won me over, and after a few years together, I began to settle inside. He didn't ask questions about the past. He's easy that way, wanting a partner to share his life, which was already big and full. He believed in looking ahead, not behind, in seeking pleasure in every moment, and he had the means to do just that. My work left little room for a husband like Aiden. and it didn't take much to convince me to leave so I could travel with him to job sites and to see his sons, one's in California and the other up in Boston. It was a different kind of running, of hiding, I can see that now. But at the time, and until a few months ago when the affair began, I thought maybe I was actually at peace. But then Aiden asked me to move out of the city. He said, we have this beautiful home in East Bay, right on the water. He could work from anywhere. What was I going to tell him? What reason could I give to not be closer to my family and to his son in Boston, to not live in this house that was his favorite place in the world? I wanted to be the person he saw when he looked at me with so much love, the woman who had stopped running, who'd finally let go of the past. We all have secrets we keep. Sometimes we don't even know we're keeping them. Aiden's house is big, but it feels like a home. And that's Aiden's gift, making each room a haven of some kind. For reading, for dining, for sipping coffee in the morning sun, for cooking, for watching TV, for making love. We slipped into a routine. Breakfast together at the kitchen island, then working in our separate studies. I had started to write again. Something I'd loved since high school, ever since our English teacher told me I was gifted. I believed him. Jeremy Ashbourne. It was the goddamn degree he had from Harvard, and the way he was with us. I'd started something back then, a novel, I suppose. But then, well, everything was upended that summer after we graduated. The summer Eve disappeared. She's still the best friend I've ever had. It'll be 15 years this week. On the 4th of July. When she didn't come home that night, when she never came back to us, it nearly destroyed me. Something shut down inside. Or maybe Eve took those things with her. The parts of me that felt alive and open to the world, that believed good things could happen if I could just stop getting in their way. Eve saw a different side of me, didn't she? And when she was gone, I couldn't stand being here. But really, I was running. Not to something, but from something. From East Bay and what happened to her. Ugh. And from the lies I told when she didn't come home that night. When Aiden brought me back here just over a year ago, I thought enough time had passed. I started writing again because that was our plan. It was the gift he was giving me. The chance to be a writer. And a wife. And maybe a mother one day. I wrote every morning since we moved back, and I finished a novel. Can you believe it? And I've started a new one. Again, writing in the mornings. It's my favorite time of day. But in the afternoons, Aiden likes to walk on the beach, and that's when they find me. The memories of Eve. Sometimes they trickle in slowly as the salty air lands on my cheeks. Sometimes they come like a swarm of greenheads, especially when the local kids make a bonfire. You can smell it from yards away. The burning wood, the bug spray, the cheap beer. And when they shoot the fireworks off the barge on the ocean, the sulfur from the smoke drifts back to the shore. It used to sting our eyes. Even the ash would reach us on the beach. It would cover our clothes and stick in our hair. Remember? Being here, in East Bay, I started to feel like I'd gone back to that 18-year-old girl. Without my work and the distractions of the city, with just Aiden and his big house and these memories right outside the door, I didn't know how to do this, how to be here with him. But he was so happy. I felt trapped. And then someone came into my life who let me escape, even for a few stolen hours. David, who let me dangle my hand over the pin of the grenade that might destroy my life, but then carefully pull it back. I told myself it was a safety valve that allowed me to stay in this life with Aiden. But of course, that's never true. It's just the lie we tell ourselves to justify our betrayal. I just need this little escape so I don't ruin my life. But really, it's the escape that becomes the ruin. I swear this was going to be the last time. After I ended it, I was going to tell Aiden how I felt living here again, show him the parts of myself he'd never seen, maybe even tell him about the lies I told that night. And let the pieces fall where they may. But then we heard the voices in the room next door. Then the silence. David walked to sit beside me on the bed where I'd pulled the covers up over my bare chest. We thought maybe it was nothing, that it was over. But then they started again.
David, seriously, what is that?
I don't know what...
We have to do something.
I know, but...
I'm sorry.
Oh, my God. David, do you think...
I don't know.
We stared at each other then, neither of us making a move. I knew the look on his face and what it meant, and he knew what I was thinking, that neither of us could tell a soul what we'd just heard. Or... that we were ever even there.
Chapter 2. Carrie, July 1st, 2025. The sun shining through the break in the curtains ends another night of restless sleep. I don't ask why. I know the reason. I reach for my phone on the bedside table and play the message that was recorded on the East Bay PD tip line 7 days ago. They used a cheap voice-altering software that ended up muddling their words, but enough to draw me in. My newest hire, Officer Jamie Bender, passed it along to me because he doesn't know any better. The other officers and staff follow them up first, and not just tips about Eve, but everything that comes in. It's about efficient delegation. And now, it hasn't left my mind since. Not for a second.
Hello, new information about that girl who disappeared from the pier at the Cosmos Arcade.
I squeeze the phone in my hand and press it to my chest as I stare at the ceiling, thinking as my eyes move around this room where I grew up. From the globe ceiling light to the wallpaper with the pink flowers, then the window sconce, and the white birch desk with a framed photo from my senior year of high school, and doodles carved into the wood. The lamp hasn't had a light bulb in it for over a decade. In the corner is my mother's old ironing board she used to use to starch my father's uniform, and the open door to a closet which now holds winter coats and boxes of old tax documents. Okay, I think, returning to the tip. This has to be a prank. Like all the others about Eve Shea's disappearance. I know it's about her. She's the only girl who's ever gone missing in East Bay, and the Cosmos Arcade out on the pier is the last place she was seen. Also, I reason, the tips about Eve's disappearance always come, when they do, around this time. When the weather turns, May seeding to June, then June giving way to the steady thrum of the summer tourist season. It's been a few years since there's been a tip about Eve, but it makes sense for them to start again, since it's been exactly 15 years since she disappeared. It's strange that we commemorate everything in 5-year tranches. Maybe it's just long enough to lay things down. Grief, forced celebration, reunions with people you don't want to see. But not so long that we forget about the past, the shared moments that stitch us together. The people we once were. And of course, the people we've lost. Whatever the reason, it's a fact. 15 years. The 4th of July nearly here. I picture a group of kids gathered around the only payphone left in town, by the Shell station, speaking into a device they bought off the internet. They probably made dozens of calls. Stupid kids. That's all this was. I had to let it go. One of the new conditions of my marriage counseling that began 3 months ago is that I stop investigating Eve's case, unless I have a damned good reason. Something concrete. I objected, of course. This is my work, my decision. I'm the chief of police. And it's not that I've been obsessed with it. The file stays on my computer at the office, and the small box of evidence fits easily under my desk. Now and again, I run the timeline, reread the statements from the witnesses, most of whom are still in town. Honestly, I think it's just an excuse. I think it's just me that Rob has grown tired of. My mother summed it up quite succinctly, in her loving but firm way, the night I arrived with packed suitcases.
You don't know how to be happy, Carrie. You never really did. Even as a child, you worried about the clouds that might roll in, then the rain that might come, not feeling the warmth of the sun shining right on your face.
Eve's case, she said, had given me the perfect excuse to focus on the misery in life and not the joy. I had to let go of what happened to her the same way we both had to let go of my father dying when I was only 12. I don't remind her of that. After 2 decades, she still lives in the same house where they raised me and my sister. His uniform still hangs in her bedroom closet. But who am I to talk? I'm the one sleeping in that house again. After going away to college and grad school, I was right back here in East Bay, working the same job my father had. When I got promoted last year to chief of police, they hung the photo of me in full dress on the same wall where his picture used to be. Until 3 months ago, I had a marriage and a child. A husband who was first selectman, a fancy term for mayor, in East Bay, and now planning to run for the state legislature. I must have some capacity for love, for happiness. I look at the phone again to check my emails, deleting the spam, flagging the stuff for work. There's a reminder about Sylvie's playdate after camp. Nothing from Rob. What am I expecting? Not a damn thing, I tell myself, as my eyes stare at the screen and my fingers click buttons. I picture him in our home, the one I left to be cooperative. Rob didn't have family nearby, he argued to our counselor. In fact, if he hadn't married me and had Sylvie, he probably wouldn't be here at all. He'd still be working in the state's attorney's office up in Hartford, a much easier path to the career in politics he always wanted. The least I could do was be present in our marriage, stop treating him and Sylvie. Yes, he'd brought her up in counseling, like another job I had to complete, things I was keeping in order, performing tasks and checking boxes. Make dinner, read a book, kiss goodnight, check, check, check. And, okay. He's not entirely wrong about how I go through life, how I lie in bed at night, running through my day, making sure that everyone I love, everyone I'm responsible for, is safe and sound. Was that from Eve? From what happened that night? Or was I always this way? I can't even remember. He brought up Eve in our last session, saying I cared more about Eve Shay than I did about them, and she hadn't been here for 15 years. The therapist latched onto this because, finally, it was something tangible. I tried to explain that Rob wasn't part of that history. He didn't understand it. What did it matter if I wanted to look into Eve's case now and again? Cold cases are solved all the time, but only if they get pulled from the back of the storage units or the old files in the data systems. Someone has to care about them. No matter what anyone says about it, I will never stop loving Eve. Checking for new leads in her case is the only way I have left to show it. And I'm the goddamned chief of police. But then, Rob reminded me that, as the town's first selectman, he's technically my boss. Touché. The therapist asked Rob if this would be a positive first step in moving toward reconciliation, a gesture on my part, a sign of my commitment to change. And he said yes. Toward the end of that session, he asked me, when was the last time that I really enjoyed being with him? When I truly desired him, not as a body on the sofa watching Netflix or a father reading to our little girl, but as a man. I couldn't answer without lying. It had been years. If trying to move on from what happened to Eve was the bitter pill I had to swallow, this was surely his. Now, I see him almost every day. Yet somehow still miss him. His scent on the pillow, and his first morning yawn always followed by a sigh, like a giant bear waking from hibernation. The second toothbrush in the holder, even the way he meticulously removes the stems from the strawberries when he cuts them for Sylvie. I finally conceded, moving the box of evidence out from under my desk. But I don't know how to stop seeking justice for Eve, to stop searching for the truth. Maybe it is more than a gesture. Maybe my happiness is locked in a cage with the evidence that has yet to show itself about that night she disappeared. 2 days later, this message was left on the recorded tip line. This tip about Eve, that's probably a prank by some kids who didn't even know her. Some 12-year-olds answering the call of a TikTok challenge who weren't even born when she went missing that night. The investigation was thorough. I'd been through the file a million times. We were all at the party on the beach. I left early, and Brooke did too, just after the fireworks. But Eve stayed. I knew she was keeping something from us, something she planned to do later that night. She was distracted, and that wasn't like her. She was always right there in the moment. The beach was the last place I saw her. But we know that she went next with a group of girls to the pier. It was a common late-night gathering place for teenagers, extending out from the boardwalk in Crichton, the town just south of us. Technically, the pier is over the East Bay line, but we pretend it belongs to them, because it's a little too low-end for our taste. First, the Cosmos Arcade, where Eve was last seen, with its green felt floors, buzzing neon machines from the early 80s, Pac-Man and Space Invaders, a row of pinball machines with salacious backboards. Next to that is a bar that never carded back then. It had a glass floor that looked down at the frothing water and seemed to play Jimmy Buffett on an endless loop. Kids would get drunk and spill out toward the fried dough shop, the ice cream parlor, or the small convenience store that mostly sold cigarettes and lottery tickets. For us, the pier was a place to be out of sight from our parents and neighbors. East Bay is a small town. Now I pick my battles, sending an officer to poke around on a Saturday night. The bar started carding kids, so that makes my life easier. Although they still walk around with vodka in water bottles or a case of cheap beer stashed in the bathrooms at the arcade. We patrol it primarily to keep kids safe. Unlike Eve, how is it that no one knows what happened to her after she got there? Stop, Carrie. Just stop.
Carrie, are you up?
I check the phone one last time, pretending not to care that there are no middle-of-the-night longings from Rob, confessions that all of this is a mistake, that he wants this break from our marriage to be over, that he wants me and Sylvie to come home. She's just turned 7. This will only get harder when school starts up again.
Carrie, time to get a move on.
I stand from the bed before my daughter bursts through the door. I straighten the sheets just as she enters, her exuberant face beaming at me, telling me Granny said it was time to get up and that she made my coffee. She's dressed for camp. Green shorts and a white t-shirt that says East Bay Community Center. Her hair is neatly combed in a ponytail, the handiwork of my mother. For the smallest moment, her face takes on a look of worry as her eyes scan my body. I'm still in my pajama shorts and a tank top, my own hair matted to the sides of my face from the heat and the restless night. And in this moment, I feel a wave of panic as a chorus of voices delivers the same message. Rob, my mother, Sylvie, even Eve would tell me. I have to find the key to this lock. That day will not be this one. There's something about this call. It wasn't a secret that she was last seen at the pier, but it's not something a bunch of punk kids would know, unless they did a deep dive into the news articles from all those years ago. That's too much effort for a prank. Or maybe I'm just making excuses. Christ, is that what this is? An excuse to keep churning an old case, feeling old pain, keeping my happiness locked away? Sylvie leaves me, racing back down the hall. I grab my phone again, this time calling Jamie. He's fresh out of college with a degree in data analysis. He's eager to please and dying to show off his tech skills. Hey, so I changed my mind about that tip you sent me. See what you can do to get the rest of it. I pause for a moment, thinking about the consequences. And then I hit send.
Chapter 3. Eve, July 4th, 2010. That night, on the 4th of July, I was sitting on the beach watching ash fall from the sky through the moonlight. It disappeared into a giant plume of smoke that had surrounded a barge after it set off the fireworks on the ocean. It looked like the smoke had swallowed it whole. I was killing time until midnight, but then I heard voices calling out to me from down the beach. It was Lisa Calder and some girls from town.
Eve! Holy shit! Your dad.
What? What's going on?
Someone saw him coming from the inn.
He's looking for you!
Oh, God.
Come on, come with us to the pier.
I can't.
He's gonna be here like any second.
Well, he knows about your plan, Eve. Come on.
He looks so pissed off. Let's go.
They were right. My best escape was to get off the beach where the bonfire was dying down and everyone was leaving for home or another party or the pier. It was after 10 and the fireworks had come and gone. Carrie had left before they even started, mad at me and Brooke for something we'd done. Messing around with a few of the summer boys who'd wandered down from the inn. It meant nothing to us, but Carrie took everything so seriously. I should have known better. I was the sober one. Brooke left, too, as soon as the fireworks ended. She had somewhere to be, using me as her cover story. And that was the problem. Brooke had told her parents she was staying at my house. I'd told my father I was staying at hers. We thought it was the perfect plan. But as I grabbed my stuff off the sand, Lisa told me that Mrs. Lowry had figured out our lie and blown our cover. We ran up the beach toward Connor Rosario's house, around the side to the driveway, and then to the street where Lisa's Chevy was parked. We piled inside, two in the front, five in the back, three girls on the bottom, two sitting on laps. They were drunk, laughing, talking about the stupid dramas that had unfolded at the bonfire. They asked me if I'd talked to Connor or Luke, both of whom had been at the beach and might also be at the pier. Connor was my ex-boyfriend who thought he still loved me. Luke was the asshole who'd broken my heart. I didn't have time to worry about either of them. I was watching for my father's car, hoping he'd given up and gone home to send me an angry text. We were in that strange world of in-between, me having graduated high school and turned 18. But me also still living at home, still piecing together money for college. But really, we'd been in a tailspin. My father lived in fear of losing me after my mother died in a car accident 8 years ago, and I lived in fear of causing him to worry. I told him little pieces of my life, doling them out carefully. Fear had come to define our entire relationship, and now there wasn't much left. He didn't know me. Still, I owed him more respect than running from him at the beach, escaping to the pier where I wasn't allowed to go this late. But there was someone I needed to see that night, and that overrode everything else, including my love for my father. It figures Mrs. Lowry would call to check on Brooke and blow our cover. She didn't like that we were friends, ever since I'd moved here in 9th grade. She called me a latchkey kid, motherless and feral. She said trouble would always be knocking on my door. Brooke would tell me these things while explaining her latest theory about her mother's behavior. She researched them online. Psychological conditions called Axis II disorders, she said. Those are the psychotic ones, she explained, as Carrie and I listened intently. The ones that can't be cured with pills and therapy. Brooke said she just had to steer clear until she could get the fuck out of here. Carrie was so patient. She would remember every detail Brooke told us, even when Brooke herself had forgotten. Which she often did. We didn't blame her. I didn't have a mother, and Carrie didn't have a father. Brooke had both parents, in the flesh. So when Mrs. Lowry softened her voice at the dinner table and asked Brooke about a test or a tryout or how her friends were doing, she would answer, honestly, expecting the reply of a mother. Because that's what was sitting right there at the table. A mother. She would forget all about her latest diagnosis. Until her mother's reply ripped out Brooke's heart, probably just healed from the last time. It was Carrie who would hold her while she cried and remind her that her mother had NPD or ASPD or BPD.
Oh, remember, Brooke? You figured it out. You told us. It's not you, Brooke. Hey, you're perfect.
I just have to get out of here.
I couldn't argue with the conclusions Mrs. Lowry had drawn about me because I'd moved from a bad section of New Haven, one that had a reputation for crime. I never saw that side of it when we lived there, but my father knew things I didn't, and he was afraid of what might happen to me, what direction I might be pulled in after I got to high school. We came to East Bay because it was a quiet, quaint community, my father said, where the people had each other's backs. It was meant to be a refuge, a place where he could let me have more freedom, knowing it was safe. He thought he would have less fear of losing me in East Bay. Maybe Mrs. Lowry was right about trouble knocking on my door, or maybe I was the trouble itself. Brooke and Carrie became my friends the first week of school. No one could figure out how this happened. They weren't in the same social groups. Brooke was already wearing makeup and a padded bra. Her shorts were short, and her sandals had a sexy wedge heel. She had long, flowing hair that she flipped from side to side like a movie star on a red carpet. We used to watch every award show together, usually in an empty room at the inn. Brooke's father would give her the key card and order us pizza. On the outside, Carrie was the opposite of Brooke, with drastically short hair and dark-rimmed glasses. Her clothes were baggy and intentionally casual. She wore Nike sneakers with short socks, like she was ready for a long hike in the woods or to kick some guy in the balls if he tried to hit on her. Losing my mother turned me into a different person. The school shrink back in New Haven said it was normal and that I would grow out of it. I'd become a scanner, always reading the room, looking for potential danger, studying people and their behavior. She said it was a normal part of trauma recovery, but I still do it. So maybe this is just who I am now. When I scanned the hallways of East Bay High School that first day, what I saw was a girl who'd watched her father die of a sudden heart attack, and another girl whose mother liked to wound her and whose father stood by and watched. It didn't matter how they'd chosen to hide, long hair, short hair. I had a feeling in my gut, an instinct. I decided to make them both my friends, and make them friends with each other as well. I suppose I thought we could heal together through our friendship. 4 years later, we were sitting in my bedroom, getting ready for the bonfire on the beach on the 4th of July. We'd become thick as thieves, my father said. There must have been a million things we'd come to know about one another, spending all that time together. But the truth is, there were twice as many that we didn't. When we saw glimpses of those things, we danced around them. All friendships require this kind of choreography. But on that night, they felt so big we were stepping on each other's toes as we got dressed for the 4th of July. Brooke with her secrets, me with mine, and Carrie, as always, standing by to pick up the pieces.
Chapter 4. Brooke, July 1st, 2025. We were both thinking the same thing, that calling the police could ruin our lives. There was no way to make a call without it coming back to us. The lies had been told. I was at a writer's group. He was at a client dinner. No one would believe that either of us had come here to be alone. Still, we didn't just run away, I promise you. David was the first to get up and look for his clothes. I followed, each of us gathering our things, prepared to leave, prepared to take action if we needed to help with whatever had happened in the room next door. The thuds, the cries, it sounded like more than a lover's quarrel. It sounded like violence. When we were dressed and had gathered all of our belongings, we stood together in the middle of the room. Our eyes were on each other, but we were listening for more sounds. Then he took me by both arms and squeezed. He told me to stay put. He said he would go to the room next door and see what happened.
And then what?
I asked him.
What are you going to do if you find something?
We only communicated on Signal. It's an encrypted messaging app. I'd never heard of it before, but David knew all about it. He showed me how to set it up so everything disappeared as soon as it was read. We were so careful. Even the way we rented the room, using fake names, paying with credit cards our spouses didn't know about. It's not that hard, you know, to get away with things these days. David said he would send a Signal message once he got to the room. He kissed me quickly, then walked out the door. I closed it behind him and turned the lock. You can't even imagine how fast my heart was beating, thinking about him going over there alone after what we'd heard. I held my phone in my hand and watched the time. 2 minutes, 3 minutes, four, then five. I walked to the wall that separated the rooms. I pressed my ear against it, listening. But I heard nothing but a soft echo of the wind traveling between the wood beams. 6 minutes, 7 minutes, 10 minutes. I refreshed the phone again and again. There were no messages. After 20 minutes, there had still been no sounds from the room next door, no sign from David. What could be happening? I thought. The pounding in my chest became an ache. I hadn't had that kind of fear since the night Eve disappeared, and we were all thinking that the worst possible thing had happened. After 25 minutes had passed, I couldn't take it anymore. I checked the room one last time, making sure everything was cleaned up. I washed his glass, wiped the doorknobs we touched. I'd never done that before when we'd stayed in this room, but I was so scared. Where was David? Surely if something had gone wrong, he would have messaged me. I went down to the parking lot. There were 6 cars spread out over the gravel. It's the kind you see near a hiking trail. No painted lines, no assigned spaces, no signs of any kind, except for the little arrows pointing to the rooms. River 1, Garden 1, River 2, Garden 2. All 8 rooms had an arrow, and next to ours was the sign for the room next door. River 3. I was about to follow the trail where the arrow was pointing, but then I realized something. I used my phone light to be sure, but then I could see. His car wasn't there. I thought, this can't be right. I felt like I was going crazy. I knew his car, didn't I? A royal blue BMW, and his plates are from Rhode Island, where he lives. I thought back to the night we met, before any of this got started, when we were just 2 strangers at a bookstore in Mystic, just another quaint coastal town on the Atlantic, in between East Bay and his home in Providence. It was because of the writing that we met. The novel I'd written. It's nothing like the one I'd started in high school, but then put away after Eve disappeared. That was a romance. I thought about a similar story this time around, but with fantasy in it, because those are so popular now. But that's not where my thoughts took me. And besides, I couldn't come up with the imaginary world 2 lovers would move through. Dragons and dominions, magical powers. Maybe because I haven't made sense of this world yet, the one we actually live in. Then, suddenly, one morning I started writing about a missing girl in a small town. I couldn't name her for almost half the book. Nothing felt right because I realized I was writing Eve. I leaned into it then, not shying away from reality, from who she was. How magnificent, how utterly irreplaceable, at least to me. And while the facts were different, the town was not set by the sea and my character went missing from a shopping mall, not an arcade on a pier, what stayed the same was the loss she left behind, the sorrow, the grief, and most of all, the mystery that still remains, her case not being solved. I was careful about skirting too close to the truth. Anytime I got near it, I found a way to turn and twist the facts of the plot away from what happened 15 years ago. Not just to Eve, but to me. The novel, if you haven't seen it, is called While You Were Gone. It got picked up by an indie publisher, and it did pretty well for what it was. I was proud of it. The themes about being a girl in a small town like this, the things that go wrong, mostly because of men. Maybe that's what the book was really about. How unfair it all was, and maybe still is. And how pushing against it can lead to, well, tragedy. There's a cute little bookstore in Mystic. The manager loved the local angle, a story set in a small Connecticut town. I went there to do a reading on a Tuesday evening in February. A small cluster of chairs were assembled in the back of the store. They had a table with copies of my book. There was no need for a pedestal or a microphone. I was just going to sit on a stool and read a chapter. I already knew what to say, what inspired the book without talking about Eve. As people were gathering, the few who came, I rushed back to my car to grab some bookmarks I'd made with my website and social media links. I always forgot them. I didn't write the book to become famous. Turns out promoting is not my strong suit. In spite of what people here remember about me, I really do hate performing. As I was walking back into the store, I felt someone come up behind me and reach for the door. He opened it for me, and I glanced at him, thinking nothing of it. Until he smiled.
Excuse me, are you here for the reading?
I am. Are you?
I just saw the sign. I was coming to grab something for my wife. Well, actually, for my daughter. Is the author any good?
I heard she's okay. I guess I'll find out soon enough. I caught David's eye when I walked to the front of the small crowd that had gathered and started to read. There was something about this man, the way he was looking at me, amused by our interaction, and now intrigued. After he bought the book for his daughter, he joined the others in the back of the store. When the reading was over, he helped me gather my things, and we walked out together. We stopped at his car, the royal blue BMW. I'll never forget it. It's not that I don't see them all the time in East Bay, but, you know, it's a nice car, so I found myself assuming he must be successful. And let's be honest, success is attractive. Nothing happened that night, just a friendly handshake. And yet, he had electrified me. I wouldn't see him again for 2 more months, but he never left my mind. I would picture him standing by that car, and when I turned back after we parted, I saw it pull out of the parking space and drive away, and I thought, thank God, because I knew that man was a fuse I could light, a grenade whose pin I could pull to blow up my life. I didn't realize I might not be the one to pull it. So, the car was gone, David was gone, and where the hell was he, I thought. I got scared. I didn't follow the path to River 3. I didn't go up the steps. I went right to my car and drove home to my husband. Aiden had fallen asleep on the sofa watching TV. The windows were open, letting in the breeze from the ocean and the sound of the waves, the salty air that stirred the memories and ignited the fear. I was careful not to wake him as I went upstairs, crawled under the covers, and prayed this had all been a bad dream.
Chapter 5. Carrie, July 1st, 2025. 20 minutes later, I'm showered and changed and in the car with Sylvie and her Barbie backpack, filled with lunch and a swimsuit, sunscreen and a towel. It's a perfect day to be a young girl at summer camp, though I can barely remember what that felt like. To step into each moment with exuberance, the cold water of the pool, a new art project that will be brought home and hung on the refrigerator, chasing a ball on a field, the sheer joy of moving arms and legs with the hot sun on bare skin. I soak up my daughter's anticipation, maybe envy it too, as we drive along the beach road to the community center. I ask Sylvie if I can kiss her goodbye before she hops out of the car. Her hand is already on the door, but she stops and leans over and gives me a peck on the cheek. She tells me to have a good day and then leaps out, her body disappearing into a swarm of girls with green shorts and white t-shirts. I close my eyes for just a second, determined to stay right here, in this moment, the way I'm supposed to. But then I hear a counselor calling out, telling me to move along, and a car honking behind me. I feel an impulse to roll down the window and tell them they'll have to wait while I practice being happy. But then I smile and wave and step on the gas, move along, move deeper into my day. By 8:30, the downtown is hopping. Kids on their bikes ride along the sidewalks, dodging and weaving around the families who were taking a stroll to get their morning coffee. The line out the door of Judy's Bagels has already spread in front of 2 store windows. Waves of Delight, which sells sea glass jewelry and mosaic tiles, and Cookin' with Class, a gourmet kitchen store where you can buy a wood cutting board shaped like a seashell for $150. East Bay is not a boardwalk town, like Crichton, just south of us. There are no shacks with fried clams and souvenirs where you can buy one, get one free of anything from a snow globe to a bobblehead. The stores in East Bay are run by local residents, artists and importers of specialty items, handcrafted kitchenware, locally designed couture. There's a strict adherence to the culture of quaintness that's described in every brochure and ad selling this place to tourists and people looking to buy a second home. At the end of the main strip is the East Bay Kitchenette, a diner where the locals come to escape the crowds. I park outside and go in for my second cup of coffee, brewed from an industrial pot with city water and light brown grinds that come in a large metal can. But it's hot and cheap, and I can be in and out in 5 minutes. The bells on the door jingle as it opens and closes, and I'm hit at once with the blast of air conditioning from the unit that hangs on the wall, and the smell of grease from the fryer making the hash browns, bacon on the grill, pancakes soaking up butter, and, of course, the acrid smell of the coffee. I walk to the counter, nodding to the older men who sit at two tables pulled together, all of them long retired, with newspapers laid out so they can complain about corrupt politicians and do the crossword puzzles. They get them from the Shell station, the only chain our zoning board approved. It still carries paper editions of the New York Times and the local rag, Coastal Chronicle. Two women I knew in high school sit with toddlers in a booth at the back, Lisa Calder and Bryn Ellis. They've been friends their whole lives. They wave and I nod, then look away. Tyler Lowry works the morning shift. I've known him since the day he was born. I remember his mother being pregnant, though I must have been only 5 at the time. It was later, after his sister Brooke and I became friends, that I got to know him better. He had a crush on Eve and would tag along when Brooke would allow it, which was less frequent than he liked, I imagine. He sees me and immediately starts to pour coffee into a styrofoam cup, adding a splash of half and half. He closes the lid, turns and places it in front of me at the counter. I lay down a $5 bill and grab the coffee, trying not to look at the horizontal tracheostomy scar on his neck.
You're getting hot out there again.
Yeah, another scorcher.
Yeah, gonna work up a sweat giving out parking tickets.
Yeah, something like that.
I'll keep on keeping on.
See you tomorrow.
It's the same conversation, more or less, every morning. Sometimes I ask about his mother or his father and the inn the family still runs. But then it sits on my tongue, the next question down this path, about Brooke and our long-lost friendship. Somehow, the counter between us makes it easy to walk away. Eve had brought me and Brooke together like an electromagnetic force. There was something about the loss of my father and Eve's mother and the disquiet within Brooke's family that bonded us. After the summer, after Eve was gone, Brooke and I broke apart and never came back together. I suppose that happens to friends. We went to college in different places, then lived in different towns. Me here, Brooke in New York. But if I'm being honest, I never forgave her for the secret she kept about the night Eve disappeared. Brooke and I haven't said more than a quick hello in all this time. Even after she moved back to East Bay with her husband, Aiden Granger, seeing Tyler most mornings and the trach scar made by paramedics to save his life after a fentanyl overdose are more than enough reminders of Brooke and the Lowry family, and that all of us underestimated the impact her disappearance had on him when he was just 13. In the short drive to the station farther from town, I think about the marriage counselor and her brilliant advice about avoiding triggers, things that will remind me of Eve and her unsolved case. I list them in my head, the ones I've already encountered before I even get to work. The road to camp, littered with signs about where to park for the fireworks. The blocks of small houses where we rode our bikes, down to the access road and the mansions along the shore. Connor Rosario's house where we parked that night. The store on Elm Street, Seaside Sundries, where Brooke stole a small bottle of vodka in 9th grade. The roads, the houses, the downtown, and now the coffee shop. Tyler Lowry and two women who were among the last to see Eve at the pier the night she disappeared. Their statements are in the box of evidence that used to live beneath my desk. My entire life was a trigger. The East Bay police station is small. Blink and you'll miss it, kind of small. A waiting area with a front desk and 3 worn-to-the-bone wood chairs with red leather seats. One closed door that leads to the back, where we have an interview room. An open space with 3 desks for clerks, techs, and the junior officers who seem to come and go every year, after the winter when they realize how dull this place can get. And then, the office at the back. Mine. I walk past Margaret, our office assistant, say a quick hello, then head back in search of Jamie to see what he's managed to sort out with the tip about Eve. I reason with myself, make a bargain. Once I know for sure it's just a prank, that will be the end of it. But right inside the door, standing by my office, is my husband, waiting for me.
Rob, what a pleasant surprise.
I know, right?
He follows me inside, and I remind myself that he's technically my boss. He has every right to be here. Rob Tremaine, East Bay First Selectman. I toss my badge and keys on the desk as if my mind isn't reeling, wondering if he knows about the tip. But then, so what? I have every right to follow leads as chief of police. But then, will this be the last straw? I didn't even make it a week after promising to stop. But then, why did I have to make that promise? Through the head-spinning contemplation, I see the tall, broad man with the slightest paunch hanging over his belt. A voice so deep it reaches me the second I enter the room, and it fills and empties all at once.
How's our girl?
Perfect, as always. Oh, she has a playdate after camp, so you don't have to leave early to get her.
Well, she's becoming quite the social butterfly.
I know. Teen years aren't looking so good for us. So, what's up?
Oh, I got a call from Barry Goldman, the mayor up in Newport.
Yeah, I know who he is.
He said some pyrotechnics were stolen off their barge. Thinking we could get some extra security around ours this year.
Okay. You could have called, you know.
I try not to read too much into this, as Rob gives me more details about the stolen fireworks up in Rhode Island. But then, we hear a soft knock on the side of the open door. Jamie is there, a Taylor Swift concert t-shirt peeking out from underneath his uniform. He swears his girlfriend bought it for him, but this is the third time he's worn it this summer. He doesn't wait to be invited in, but walks right up to my desk, standing next to my husband, my boss. He seems flustered.
Chief.
What you got?
A body.
A what now?
A body. Pulled into a fishing net. A trawler from Stonington. They called the Coast Guard and the Coast Guard called us and now they're bringing it to the closest dock. Which is here.
Oh, fuck.
Jamie, wasn't there that, an MPA last week? A guy who didn't make it home to his wife and kids after some client dinner in New Haven?
Yeah. A guy from Newport.
Okay. Where exactly is that boat headed?
The East Bay Inn.
Well, this day just got exciting.
I tell Jamie to call the closest available state forensics team, probably Meriden or New Haven. Ask them to meet me at the inn. Then he can find out what he can about the missing person from Newport. He rushes out, excited and nervous. I look at Rob and see the worry lines deepen between his eyes. I don't ask if he's going to follow us there. The East Bay Inn is packed with tourists for the holiday weekend. Controlling the narrative to protect the season is in Rob's domain. East Bay would be nothing without the summer people. I gather the things I'd just placed on my desk. Badge, keys, coffee. As we head toward the door, he places his hand on the small of my back. And I know I'll feel it there for the rest of the day.
Chapter 6. Eve. July 4th. 2010. Carrie sat on my bed as I curled Brooke's hair into beach waves. She was scrolling through a playlist on the iPod her mother had given her for graduation, looking for a song. We stayed in that silence, with only the soft sizzle of the iron and the clicks of the iPod, until Brooke couldn't take it anymore. Her secret was bubbling inside her, and as much as she didn't want Carrie to know, she was bursting at the seams with excitement.
Eve! Eve, come on!
Brooke, hold still. I'm almost done.
I found it.
Oh, we need to go. We'll never find parking.
Mr. Rosario said we could park in their driveway.
Mr. Rosario? I thought Connor's family hated you.
Yeah, Eve, after you broke his heart into a million little pieces.
His whole family doesn't hate me.
His mother hates you.
No, she doesn't. Well, maybe. It doesn't matter. Mr. Rosario said we could park at the...